Hi, and welcome to Jackie Winter Gives You the Business. I'm Jeremy Wartzman, and I'm here with my co-host, Laura Chan Baker.
Hello.
Hello. Here at Jackie Winter, our roles put us right in the center of the action, in between client and creative, so we get to see all sides of the process. Each week, we come together in the home brand Tupperware that is our recording studio and dissect three different links we've come across during our recent internet travels. We use these as a jumping off point to look at what's shaping the issues, processes, happenings, and ideas across the creative industries today. This week, we are going through our open tabs and we'll be discussing the search for Generation Z, 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 Pandora's new Sonic logo, and the importance of morale and motivation as management tools. Helping us bring some outside perspective today is our very special guest, Erica Gerards. Erica is an impressive woman. First, she co-founded content agency Willow & Blake, co-directed the company for 5 years. Then in 2013, she co-founded skincare company Frank Body, which went on to become an international beauty sensation. In 2016, Erica left Willow & Blake and Frank Body and has since been working on her newest venture in beauty, Fluff, a brand with a mission to empower and draw inspiration from teenage girls, simplifying beauty products and embracing reality. We've mentioned Fluff various times in the podcast because of Erica's refreshingly transparent approach of sharing the ins and outs of building the business. And we're so delighted to have her here. Erica, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
Oh, nice to have you here. Mm. And both of you are sort of floating head style today. We often talk about this, wearing black in the hot box room.
We're mourning for the beautiful weather that is no longer with
us. I'm dressed like Christmas.
You're very festive.
I've accidentally, dressed like a watermelon or like Christmas, whichever you want. Take your pick.
And Erica, you're preparing to do the base camp in Kathmandu soon. Is that right?
I am.
Are you ready?
My sister would argue that I'm not ready, but I'm mentally and emotionally prepared, so I feel good about it.
You just want to get away from your computer.
Laura, everything going well with you?
Yeah. By the time this episode comes out, so the Comedy Festival started here in Melbourne, right? And I'm seeing 10 shows this week, which means I've got multiple shows a night. Wow. So by the time this episode comes out, I'm going to have laughed so hard and also be really fucking over comedy. But I'm super excited.
Excellent. Well, let's get straight into it. What do you got for us this week, Laura?
Yeah, I was really happy to come across this article this week. It was totally by chance because I just think it was like the perfect thing to discuss with you, Ari. It comes from The New Republic and it's titled In Search of Generation Z.
New Republic making a premiere on the show.
You know what? I think so.
Where'd you get this one from?
From The New Republic.
No, but like where? Do you read The New Republic?
Yeah, it's in my feed. It's in my RSS.
Oh, right. Cool.
There you go. And I'm going to stick with Z over Z, but the subheading says it all really. So an unscrupulous, money-hungry marketing industry helped define the millennials, often with wildly inept results, and now it's getting to work on the next cohort. So as this kind of hints at, the article is a bit of a look at the industry that surrounds research into the next generation, and the writer, Daniel Kollitz, he clearly isn't too hot on it. In his words, identifying a distinct generation of American humans possessed of a vast array of seemingly occult characteristics, which, once discovered and isolated, can then be analyzed, catalogued, and sold to the highest bidder. So again, to read from the piece, the marketing gurus have only recently completed their lovingly assembled profile of the millennial generation, and their work is a true wonder to behold. A trail of mangled slang, twitching meme gifs, and fast food brands masquerading as witty, clinically depressed 20-somethings. But now, a new generation, 61 million strong, is marching to maturity, wreathed in jewel vapor and wielding billions of dollars in purchasing power. The brands, naturally, want to know about them. What are these creatures like? What are their hopes, their dreams? Do they value fresh ingredients? What is their attitude in aggregate towards shopping at the mall? The ethnographic entrepreneurs who cut their teeth on the millennials are rapidly expanding into the Generation Z racket, and they are inevitably going to get it very wrong. So the piece sort of goes on to look at some of the characteristics that have been assigned to this new generation by various people, some of which are, you know, like they're earnest, hardworking, driven by conservative views of success, taught that they actually can't be anything they want compared to us. And I say us, but Jeremy, we're in different generations. They have this sort of pragmatic mindset when it comes to planning and preparing for the future. They've never known a world without the internet, and they have attention spans that average 8 seconds. There's an embrace of the trashy or obscene as like this kind of punkish rebuke to Instagram's lifestyle cult, a resurgence of Kerouac-style counterculturalism expressed via podcasts and DIY urban farming initiatives. And looking at insights drawn by various researchers from marketing consultancies, the piece also looks briefly at how they actually went about deriving that information. At one point, the writer sits in on a research session with a bunch of like Gen Z youths, their discussion kind of winds its way into this complex, impassioned discussion about gender as it relates to the wing, the Women's March, hashtag Me Too. And one of the youths asks, why would we go forward in any sort of revolution without being able to revolutionize ourselves? And the writer sort of notes here, like, you could almost picture the question tweaked and decontextualized in an 8-second Instagram ad, yoga pants maybe, or online banking. Again, I guess, you know, the writer here just like highlighting their feelings about the kind of capitalist system and the way that sort of people's very real feelings and passions are turned into marketing fodder to sell all sorts of products. And I think, you know, looking back at the way millennials, my own cohort, have been chronicled, there's no doubt that there's been a litany of unrelenting analyses about our kind of our laziness or our inability to stay in one job or our obsession with selfies. And as a writer sees it, you know, you gather these all up, the op-eds, the tweet threads, the TED Talks, the news segments, and you have this kind of pile of punditry that's not necessarily fact-based. But I guess in recent years, some of this has given way to at least some kind of fact-backed portrait that presents things with a bit more accuracy, that, you know, millennials are culturally distinct from their forebearers for sure, but distinguished chiefly by the magnitude of their debt and the paucity of their prospects. But the problem, according to the article, is that it seems we've kind of learned very little from our sort of hyperventilating approach to the millennials. And as millennials kind of fade and Generation Z comes into the fore, we sort of can probably expect the usual hand-wringing and contrarianism, you know, like this, there's always the like, you know, Gen Z is too cautious, but they're also too hasty. And like there's these sort of two sides of things. You guys know how it goes. So to close it off, the writer talks to Chuck Underwood, who's a pioneer in the field of generational studies. And his thesis is that Generation Z doesn't exist. Mm. He thinks that there are some real key things missing here that make it just too early for a full diagnosis, if you like. You know, he looks at like, what were their parents like? And he says, the bottom line is that there's been no real significant change in family life from what the millennials came of age with. Parents might have eased up on the helicoptering, but they still divorce at high rates. Single parenting jumped somewhat between 1990 to 2005, but the major rift in the kind of nuclear family system occurred much earlier. And then his second major criteria is religion. He says, look, there's no major changes there. Religion's declining, but that started decades ago. Criteria number three, government. Millennials came of age when, you know, government was dysfunctional, sleazy, angry, and politically divided. And how different does that sound from what today's teenagers are experiencing? And so he says, before we declare a new generation has arrived, the differences have to be profound. One generation ends, the next begins, only when the times and the teachings that young kids absorb mold core values that are significantly different from the generation just ahead of them. And we haven't seen it yet. And in closing, the writer, Daniel, he presents the following. He says, every generation gets its emblematic middle-class stereotype, the buzz-cut GI with a flask in his suit pants, the long hair whooping it up for civil rights, a yuppie with one of those huge beige cell phones, Ethan Hawke in Reality Bites, a kid in a unisex American Apparel zip-up texting. The wax figure Z is still being molded, but once it's ready, we will mock it and sell it credit cards and blame it for the decline of retail footwear or casual sex. Meanwhile, 61 million young people will live 61 million different lives, about which, for now and maybe forever, it would be futile to generalize. So the reason I've gone into all of this is because, Ari, I actually really, really admire the way that you have tackled this kind of question. And your experience in the area is really relevant because, you know, you went from Frank, which obviously wrote and is still writing the influencer wave with its kind of millennial focused marketing. And now you started Fluff as this kind of concerted effort to back away from these sort of more unrealistic messages and talk to sort of real life young people and figure out how you can help encourage healthier, happier values, right? I'm just, I guess, super interested to hear your thoughts on this article and about that kind of fine line between creating and exploiting a stereotype and developing something that a part of the market really wants and loves. But I guess just to give people some context first, I would love to hear a bit more about, you know, your time with Frank and what led you to leave that and like sell your shares and start Fluff.
Totally. So for me, Frank was an incredible stepping stone and learning experience. I started that company when I was about 23. So I was there from 23 to 26.
Jesus.
Super young, right? And we were very ambitious but naive at the same time. It was very much a brand challenge for Jess, Bree and I at Willow and Blake. And it was this novelty product that wasn't on the market yet. Mm. So we had no idea what it would become. We didn't start with a business plan forecasting where we would be in 2, 5, 7, 10 years' time. It was basically, let's see what we can do. Can we have fun? Can we create a product that people want?
Mm.
And can it make us a couple of $100 on the side on the weekend? And it obviously grew to be this huge company.
Yeah, behemoth. That's,
pretty crazy, right? And I had a lot of fun, learned so much. I'm so grateful for the experience and what I shared with Bree and Jess and Steve and Alex as well. But it got to a point at 3 years, the catalyst for me was that we were seeking overseas investment. And as part of that, we had to sign on for 5 years as co-founders. And prior to that, I'd been very much in control of my career and the direction I was going. I could change at any point if I wanted to. But this was having to kind of lock myself in. And yeah, I was 26 and really had to make that call. Is this what I want? It was
a chance. For the next 5 years.
Yeah. And was just really a chance for me to stop and be like, am I happy? Is this what I want to do? Because the business had been growing so quickly and moving so fast, and you often don't get the chance to stop and be like, how did we get here? And now that we're here, is this what I wanted or what I want going forward? And we had a huge audience with Frank Body at the time. I think we had something like almost 700,000 Instagram followers. And I all of a sudden became very aware of the responsibility that came with that. That was a result of some very specific conversations I had with friends, with people in the industry, with other founders. And I really, I think, started figuring out or trying to question where I stood in regards to purpose versus profit in business. And that's something that this article obviously speaks to.
Absolutely. Because I've heard you talk before about your frustrations with people trying to sort of classify people, but then again, in particular as well, kind of Gen Z, and, you know, without actually talking to them directly. And I'd love to hear more about like the work you've done with Fluff specifically and how you've kind of worked with people in that age group to develop something specifically for them. And like, I mean, what did you think of this article?
When I first received the article from you, I was like, oh, should I be offended or is this a compliment?
No. Oh my God, no.
No, I just read the headline and I was like, am I one of these people taking advantage of and exploiting a generation? But I very quickly knew exactly what you were getting at. I thought the article was awesome.
I think you do it in the right way.
But it's interesting because we definitely receive feedback of which people think we're not doing it in the right way, or I think they make assumptions based on a general overview of the industry or how other brands have been treating this generation or millennials, probably more
so. Yeah, I mean, beauty companies don't have the best track record.
Exactly. And that's something that I knew we would face as a company and me personally, especially coming off the back of Frank Body, which had a more traditional approach to influencer marketing. And it's something that I really welcome discussion around. And I don't have all of the answers. Certainly some of the things I say won't please everybody. And for everyone who loves what we're doing, there will be someone who doesn't agree with it. And all I can do is basically welcome that conversation. But for me, I became really interested in this younger generation because of a few things. One was how much time I'd spent in the beauty industry, both between Frank Body and the other clients we were servicing at Willow and Blake. And a lot of brands typically target the millennial consumer because it's easier to sort of speak to younger and older on either side. But this Generation Z, anyone between, say, 13 to 22, felt sort of largely ignored. And there are a lot of reasons that people and brands discuss why they choose to stay away from that. And one, they don't want to be seen as exploiting this younger generation, but mostly that it's so hard to understand how to talk to them because they really are going through this sort of, we call it a whip, like they're a work in progress, right? They don't yet fully understand who they are or what they're going through, and they're trying to figure it out. Totally, right?
Yeah.
But I kind of felt like there were enough brands catering to this millennial audience, but surely there was room for something that spoke directly to this younger audience and could do it in a positive way, not be taking advantage of them.
And because you've worked, I mean, like I see that a lot of the content that you guys put out is actually produced by people in that kind of age group. So how do you go about, like, I guess, finding those people and working with those people in a way that is, like, I guess, encouraging and supportive both for you and for them? Yeah, tell us more.
So from day one, I knew that while my background is a copywriter and I'm now starting to say, maybe I'm okay as a copywriter, I'm good. I knew I could do a fairly, like, a reasonable job at talking to this audience or connecting with them, but I knew I would never be able to nail it completely. I'm 29 years old and there is a big gap between what I'm going through now as opposed to what a 13 to 20-year-old is going through. And while I can connect or relate to that experience of figuring themselves out, I was once a teenager, and we can connect on that level, the mediums to which they're exposed or communicating with each other are very different to what I had when I was their age. And that's basically what we try and acknowledge and understand. And we have to do that through speaking to them.
Fascinating. I mean, the article itself has a pretty dark view of generation-based marketing at all. How do you kind of, you touched on this earlier, but like, how do you reconcile that like business profit-focused end of running a company with the values of creating something that's honest and transparent? I think like from the outside, it seems like you've managed to marry those things in a beautiful way, in a way that I see like kind of reflected in what we do, and that like, obviously we're a business, but also there's values in trying to like create a thriving art industry and help artists. And, you know, so it's like you're marrying the kind of the need to make money from something with something that's actually important and useful. And I'd love to hear your thoughts on that.
It's honestly extremely hard and it's a cause of a lot of pain for me probably every second day, because we are so clear on our mission or our vision for what Fluff will be and how it can represent this audience and speak to them and be responsible for, I guess, the messages that we're putting out and this generation that is growing up. However, we need to make money to continue to spread that message. And I was having this very conversation last night with some friends of mine where they actually said to me, you're doing a disservice to your company and to your message if you don't push this out aggressively. And I found that quite interesting, because if I had millions of dollars of backing and could afford to do this really slowly and make every decision from our kind of heart and this like pure decision, I would, but it's not often the case. And the beauty industry is a very expensive industry to operate in. I can acknowledge that there's great margins for us as well. It's a huge industry. It's worth almost $400 billion. But it's not cheap to do things properly.
I can't imagine.
So that's something that, yeah, I have to deal with sort of every day, and we have to be really open as a team and discuss that about what we're comfortable with. But at the end of the day, like, how do we scale our message? That is the hardest thing for us.
I think the way you guys have gone about it, obviously you're learning as you go as well with any sort of new company, but I think the way you guys go about it is amazing, especially with the newsletters, which we've talked about here before. We absolutely love that and admire that. Jeremy, before we move on, I just want to ask you, I mean, your kids are technically Gen Z, right?
Are they?
Are they?
Well, how have they defined? Has he given a bracket at all?
I think it's like in the article, he says 95 to 2005.
Yes. Well, on the cusp of it. I don't even know what year my daughter was born. It's all kind of.
Do you think there are like key differences in there? Like, I mean, maybe they're too little to tell, but like, do you think they are an entirely different generation at this stage?
Well, look, I think it's too early to tell. And I kind of really agree with the whole idea that it's impossible to segment people like this at the moment, because I think the changes are just becoming so much more subtle. And I was reading something the other day where they were kind of talking about how what defines generation is really kind of rites of passage. And basically one of the biggest rites of passage, was in kind of the 60s and 70s with kind of drug culture as well. And why the drug war was kind of so threatening, because like people were taking these drugs that were kind of saying like, hey, maybe I don't want to kind of fight in a war, you know, and really experiencing this reality that was totally different to that of their parents. And that created a real distinct difference in kind of culture, because there was this kind of rite of passage experience that made these two different realities. And so I think there was obviously a much bigger shift for people that grew up kind of with the internet, and their reality is totally different. And I like the term that they use in this article here. And so, yeah, he talks about this phygital environment, PHIG, which is kind of the real world and the virtual world naturally kind of overlap. And I think that's kind of where, you know, I guess the millennials would kind of be in that way. And yeah, for my kids and the younger generation, it's like, I kind of think it is like so much of our language is defined by the different tools that we use, especially around social media. So you can see all these kind of different visual cues and all of these kind of things that people value is kind of dictated by that. So I think whatever is going, like, we talk about this with trends all the time. Everything's just kind of a reaction to kind of everything else. So I kind of feel that these changes are going to get much more subtle and in much kind of shorter bursts. And so you're not going to have an entire generation of people. It might be kind of these qualities that, are just apparent for a short time within a certain smaller age bracket.
There you have it. Jeremy's hot generational take. I love it.
Laura, great link. Thanks very much for bringing it to the table.
You're welcome.
We will move on from there.
Cool.
My turn. I never know how to start
the child in the room.
My turn.
Very,
what's my generation?
I don't know.
I don't know what I am.
Like a,
Anyway, there you go.
Boomer. No, you're not a boomer.
Come on. Jesus. My
why?
Link of the, what?
Is it why?
Is it why?
Yeah.
I have no idea.
Yeah. Anyway, continue.
There you go. It's all about me. And my link of the week comes from Ad News. Probably the one side whose pop-up / paywall might actually break me down into paying for it monthly. I should
seriously?
Just, I can. It's so hard to get around. Anyway, that's... This piece is written
It's not, and I'll tell you how later.
I've tried it. I know what you're talking about.
The
anyway,
Google thing?
Yeah, yeah, the okay. Google thing. No, okay, maybe that go in thumbs up. So written by George Sleffo, he's reporting that Pandora has become the first major audio streaming platform to adopt a sonic logo, or a tune basically that it hopes consumers will associate with its brand wherever it's heard. So I know we've spoken a lot about VX before, or kind of voice interfaces, most recently with Georgia Frances King on the AI front, more in kind of, you know, these kind of software assistants. But this is the first time I actually heard the term sonic logo. Mm. So that really kind of drew me in to read the article. So look, brands associating themselves with sound is nothing new. I mean, take the entire jingle industry going back to the first days of advertising on radio. And until most recently, you know, Apple startup chime, which was actually axed like a few years ago. I mean, that's such a great sound, you know?
Yeah, I like the sound.
The lows and the highs. It just felt, you know, I don't know, it gets in you. Anyway, it's not there anymore. But yeah, these sounds are definitely, you know, visceral, have a strong connection with the brands they represent. So I was really surprised to hear that Pandora has been the first of the punch on this, like in the audio platforms. So at the moment, the Sonic logo only exists in the Sound On brand campaign, and you can hear it in the article link. And I have to say, I absolutely hate it. It's so bad.
Yeah, I'm not a
I
fan.
Actually pressed play a couple of times because I was like, what? Is that it?
Yeah.
So the company says they might play the logo when somebody opens the app, and there's the idea that it might be actually personalized on the for the type of music that they listen to. So this is actually what I found the most fascinating. So print designers have been championing fluid and dynamic brands identities for years. So I don't know if you know, like the Whitney identity, you know, that W that kind of always modifies depending on where it's going or something like
the ABC one.
Yeah, exactly. The ABC, the ABC was a really early version
Hell
of it,
yeah.
actually.
Mm.
Or Nickelodeon, you know, where they have like the logo and then it's filled in or kind of treated differently. So every logo is now fluid. And the idea that they can do the same thing for audio is not surprising. And I'd love to hear how this sounds in other genres. So like that's a, I think kind of technically, that's what I'm interested in with this logo. So they've managed to get a lot of elements. They have voice, drums, melody, etc. And they could easily just swap in other instruments or voices to create an infinite number of combinations, but it would still be identified as Pandora. So there's a few interesting quotes in here that I want to kind of pick apart. So most of them come from Steve Keller, which is Pandora's Sonic Strategy Director. Great fucking business card title right there. And he describes the logo as a delight, as of course he would. He says it took the company roughly 6 months to develop its new logo, adding that such a turnaround is fast when compared to other companies who attempted a similar feat. Visa, for example, spent a year developing a sound that lasts less than a second long. Grammy winner and composer Matt Winegar, I'm not sure, created the 3-second audio logo, which is really interesting. I mean, you know, we sometimes things come up like the Melbourne logo, for example, you know, it's like, oh, it costs $750,000 to do. And you kind of, it's like, how did it cost so much to make something so small? So I'm really interested to see what the process is. And I think there's another link I might post on, you know, the Culture Gap Fest, the podcast.
Well, they talk about how they received like 200 different versions through the various rounds of revisions. So you can see there why it took so long.
But yeah, another link I wanted to point out was there's an episode from the Culture Gap Fest when they changed their theme song into a theme song that I also hate completely. But they go over this kind of sound process of creating a podcast kind of intro, which is really fascinating. We'll post that link up there. But look, there's a quote from a Mindshare executive, and he says, I'm quoting again here, it's important to consider the cues associated with the experience or the product the brand has. Beyond that, you have to ask, what are the emotional nuances? Because sound triggers high response in the emotion centers in our brain. The chance to evoke emotion and even experience with a composition of cues in a short period of time is a huge opportunity. And because sonic branding would be relatively short experience, you have the entire attention of the consumer. Their mind isn't wandering. I hear energy, friendly, humanness, and a group of voices, both male and female. What you're hearing now is a starting point, and we will drill that into your ears and brain like an earworm. But as we change
really
it up over time, it may reflect a certain mood, or listener will start to hear Pandora and the melody may speak to them differently. So I mean, like, the idea of something being drilled into my ears and brains is not something I would describe as especially pleasant or desirable. And I think, I don't know, for me growing up with advertising, I've always expected and never really minded like the visual atmosphere of being filled with this kind of content. But I don't know, something about audio seems just much more intimate and unavoidable. Like, you can always close your eyes or kind of look away, but like, if stuff's coming in your ears, you can't just kind of stop it. I don't know. So I just wonder how and if the space will go about being regulated in a way, like if there's going to be, you know, there's clear guidelines for what you can and cannot show on visual ads. So I hope someone out there is considering how the oral world of, you know, this kind of content will be modulated in the same way. But look, regardless of all that, I think it's exciting to see how brands are being pushed to redefine the space in which they exist. So, Ari, I just wanted to kind of hear from you. I mean, how you approach non-traditional branding. I mean, especially for something like Fluff, which I think is, you had taken a very kind of different approach. From an outsider's perspective, you've actually used the kind of shape of the products themselves in a very kind of sculptural way that really feels, you know, brandable to me. So, I mean, how deliberate were these decisions that you were kind of making, and how else have you considered kind of pushing the envelope of what constitutes a logo or a brand?
I think for us, with every decision we've made at Fluff, we ask ourselves this question of, just because something can exist doesn't mean it should exist. And this Sonic logo kind of begs that question for me. It really reminds me a little bit of, say, like QR codes, where everyone's like, great idea, who's going to use that? Which, you know, and we discuss this as well at Fluff, like, what would we do? We have created a QR code. For us, our product has been very deliberate, but it definitely didn't start that way, or I guess the level of intent didn't start that way. We had a packaging concept for our bronzing powder that was fully developed, ready to go. And then we were in Hong Kong for Cosmoprof, which is a huge packaging expo, where we walked for hours and hours through thousands of stalls. And we actually came across one supplier who works with this mixture of metal alloys called Zamek. And I had seen a couple of other products that were made using Zamek, which I loved, but didn't really, it wasn't a possibility or in my scope that we could do something like that. And then we met this manufacturer, had a chat, realized that we could, and basically pivoted everything, which cost us time and a lot of money. But I'm so glad for that kind of pivot. It's been amazing for us, and we're so proud of our new packaging. And it really has become this iconic shape or object that our consumers love and repost and talk about.
What do you think is special about it that people respond to it in that way?
This packaging actually really connected with our message and our strategy or marketing strategy of being a mirror to our audience. So instead of telling these girls or this generation what to think, we really let them tell us what they're thinking. Or our whole aim is to just reflect the conversations that they're having, reflect their actions, their attitude, instead of pushing a specific dialogue or idea onto them. So to literally have the exterior of our packaging be a mirror that they could hold in their hands and see themselves in, the way that the metal actually works or curves is it does distort the reflection a little bit, which really speaks to our conversation around questioning what true beauty is, and is beauty makeup or is it more than makeup, which is our main sort of dialogue that we're having with our customers right now. I think we really wanted to have something that they could hold in their hand and assign value, like literally through the weight of it. And people look at it on the website, but until they hold this compact in their hand, it's so amazing seeing their reaction, and they really feel like it's something that they don't just want to throw into their makeup bag. Like people put it on the table or on their desk or when they're out at dinner, like they want to carry it with them. And we based the final design actually on a grounding stone, which was in the shape of a cloud. And we had been through so many different iterations of shapes.
Sorry, just what's a grounding stone?
A grounding stone is, I guess, same sort of, it could be made out of metal or it could literally be a rock, but they sign, it kind of leans toward either meditation or some sort of spiritual sense or connection with itself. But the pure weight is something that you feel grounded to. The very feel or texture of the compact as well, like it's so smooth and quite cold. So it evokes quite an emotional experience, which seems a bit kind of crazy to think when someone's holding a bronzing powder, right?
Nothing crazy at all.
But even when we hand it to guys who come in or boyfriends of some of the girls, they're like, this is really cool. And just having it in your pocket, it's something you can feel and that you're conscious of each day. That paired with, I guess, our brand message, it's sort of like a constant reminder for people about the values that we're trying to push out.
It's really interesting. And I think, you know, that ties in a lot. And we go back to the Gen Z question. You know, we've talked a lot about mental health in that generation as well. And everyone kind of, you know, having their own kind of issues and there being this kind of second component to the product. That's something that is really interesting to hear about. And also, I'm assuming that you could have probably made it a lot lighter and it would have been a lot cheaper to make and a lot cheaper to ship. But you deliberately decided not to do that, I assume.
Our manufacturer told me a couple of weeks ago that we are literally their most expensive client in terms of the product that we produce with them. And in an industry where especially the bigger companies are all so focused on having the cheapest product out there and getting their costs down every single day, we really are taking a backwards approach. But as I mentioned,
sometimes a backwards approach is what's required. Like if you're trying to actively do something different to what everyone else is doing, then, you know, taking that same path isn't going to get you there.
Yes. And I've always said from day one that there's enough makeup out there. To be honest, the world doesn't need more, especially doesn't need more shitty formulas or shitty packaging. So we really want to have better formulas, better packaging, but most importantly, a better brand and a more responsible one. And we need to connect all those dots because consumers, and especially this younger generation, are very skeptical of brands. They can see through these messages that everyone puts out. So if we're not, I guess, reflecting or really living our values, there's just no point of us existing.
This is a bit of a diversion here, but yeah, I'm curious how the environmental aspect kind of plays into your packaging as well. So obviously there is a utility there that goes beyond the just housing the product, but that seems to be only active when, you know, the product is kind of there in it. How do you kind of, and if you look at kind of Gen Z and kind of what they are engaged with and yeah, making sure that all their purchases are kind of ethical, like in that way, how have you addressed kind of that side of the life cycle?
Yeah, and it's really big for our customers in terms of sustainability and packaging. It's one of the biggest concerns or comments that we get from our audience. For us, we've had to do everything in stages, and a big thing for me and why I write these emails for people to understand that the business of fluff is communicating what it takes to get that product out there and the costs and the processes. Because for us, we had to release our compact as it is, and our second iteration and order will actually have a divot so the pan can be replaced or refillable, which is really important for us because it's this beautiful heavy-weighted compact that doesn't break, that doesn't scratch or, I guess, wear down like other plastic or shitty cardboard boxes would. And that was really important for us. But to be able then communicate to our customers and say, you can have this for a couple of years if you really wanted to. Mm. I mean, if you want to buy a new shiny cloud, cool, order another one. But if you're really concerned about the environment and packaging, we've answered that and you'll be able to refill the compact.
Awesome. And yeah, you did allude to your newsletter, and I don't want to make this a huge plug fest, but I love it. It's one of the few that I read whenever it comes out. There's some great insight in there. I mean, yeah, all these kind of subtle ways of branding are so interesting. I mean, going back to the sonic side of things, like I know, for example, every time I watch an HBO show and you get that static thing, it's like you just feel like what you're going to watch is going to be good for some reason because there's that association. And do you guys remember when Subway used to pump out the bread smell in front of their... You know, they're using all the kind of senses. So look, I mean, Laura, this isn't the first time we've talked about VX, as I kind of mentioned. You know, it's obviously something we're going to be hearing, talking about much more in the future. Do you have any hot takes you want to leave us with at all?
Yeah, I mean, VX... voice experience, kind of moving on from user experience, I guess, and looking at, I mean, yeah, as you said, like this is something we talked about a lot with Georgia Frances King last season, I think it was. And yeah, I mean, sonic branding is by no means new, you know, like you look at radio or whatever, but it is becoming, I guess, this really interesting area again as voice tech and branding becomes kind of interactive and two-way. I think like with all tech developments though, there has been both a lot of overestimating and a lot of underestimating how it's going to, like, you know, what impact it's going to have. And I think it is a really hot panel topic at like every conference at the moment, but it is clear that there has been like a pretty incredible embrace of voice technology. I was reading some research that predicted that by 2028, 50% of all computer interactions will be conducted via voice-mediated artificial intelligence, which is like, that's pretty crazy. And I guess even if you don't believe that particular number, there are definitely signs that voice tech will play a much larger role in our day-to-day over the coming years. And you only sort of need to look at the products that the kind of Apples, Googles, Samsungs of the world are focusing on, and also what like VCs are pouring their money into. And, you know, you can see that the role that voice plays in those things. Now, like, of course, it's such a hot topic at the moment because of smart speakers like Google Home, Amazon Alexa, you know, they've found their way into millions of homes around the world. And of course, there's like the incredible surge in popularity of audio-based mediums like podcasts and audiobooks, particularly our podcast. Then again, you know, like the same research that I mentioned before, it claimed that only 2% of marketers had considered voice marketing a priority at all at the start of 2018. So it's interesting to watch that shift with big companies like Pandora making it a key consideration. I saw that MasterCard also released a sonic logo a couple of months ago.
Well, yeah, we talked about that in the intro.
Oh, right. Sorry, I missed that. But like theirs is cool because like they definitely did what you were talking about in terms of shifting the melody, like treating it differently depending on the application. Like they have versions of it with like traditional Indian instruments or sung by opera singers, or there's like a salsa style one or whatever. And I think, yeah, it is interesting to see how sound can be played with to be both like memorable or identifiable, but also like malleable and adaptable. But yeah, the whole idea of VX, of, you know, voice experience, is to sort of move us beyond sheer utility, right? Yeah. Like, and to actually provide an experience for mm-hmm. the user. And I think voice activated tech is so interesting because it doesn't have the same barriers to entry as some things. Like teaching people to use it isn't hard when it works well, at least, because it doesn't actually require any new skills or like working with a complex interface. You know, like anyone can talk to it. It's kind of our basic instinct in terms of how to communicate with each other being utilized in this new way. And I think it's easy to see how voice will be everywhere in sort of utilities, but I think we're all waiting to see how advertising and voice will truly sort of combine in this new era, because I don't think anyone has a really like clear idea yet of how it's going to manifest. I think, you know, there's lots of strict policies around like third-party ads and stuff on those devices in particular. And so there's going to need to be sort of, I guess, some sort of pure innovation in those areas, because you don't have the same option as of like interruption as you do with TV or radio in terms of like just shoving an ad in someone's face or even with the internet, you know? So brands have to kind of create these experiences of their own. Like they have to identify a utility that they can provide users, whether that's like entertainment or content or transaction. And it's like, it's just quite a different narrative. Like you look at skills, which is like the term that Amazon uses for, I guess, what are essentially like third-party apps that companies can design to expand Alexa's repertoire and give the smart device more abilities. And Gimlet Media, the podcasting company, they haven't, I mean, there's like millions of Alexa skills, but they have one that I was reading about the other day that like gamifies the experience of brushing teeth for kids.
Chompers.
Yes. Do you use it? Yeah. Oh my God. But yeah, I mean, like when you see children embracing voice tech so heavily, and like you've mentioned multiple times, Jeremy, that Winnie like uses yours at home all the time, it's not hard to imagine this world that's kind of led by a voice. And I think for me, what will be particularly interesting to watch is the same thing that's kind of affecting all other areas of tech at the moment, and which we've talked about extensively recently on the podcast. And that's the shift towards privacy and like a kind of general increasing of awareness around handing your data over to corporations. But like, you know, privacy and convenience, and for that matter, privacy and advertising are kind of in direct opposition of each other. And I think that becomes ever more intensified when we're looking at voice tech, and the desire sort of for both privacy, but also convenience is currently really, really strong. So it'll be interesting to see how that battle kind of plays out. But I wanted to just close off with, like, I was reading this article in Wired a little while ago now. I think it was like last year. I dug it up again for this podcast. The writer there, he's talking about like the three epiphanies that he had that made him realize like this move sort of towards voice first was really happening. And he's talking about spending an afternoon with his Amazon Echo, shopping for items, organizing his calendar, messaging friends, just like chatting to Alexa. And then like fast forward 4 hours later in his car, and he like suddenly remembers something he forgot to order or search or whatever. And he just like shouts Alexa into the empty car, like forgetting that he wasn't actually like near his Echo. And he talks about, you know, like the wave of stupidity and embarrassment, but also just how strong the realization was that like something had kind of snapped in his relationship with computing. And like, in his words, he says, like, using a keyboard and mouse to manipulate a computer after successfully using voice feels about the same as using a command line interface on an old Unix machine after using a graphical interface. In a word, it's starting to feel a little barbaric, and furthermore, has a certain never going back to that crap quality to it. Amazon's Echo sales have shattered all analyst estimates. Apple is rushing to catch up via its new HomePod, and Facebook just announced its own smart speakers slated to appear this summer. This is an old article. Everyone will soon be having the what the fuck, I want to talk to the internet now tantrum that I had inside my car. And I just think it's like, it's fascinating how we adopt these crazy new ways of interacting with the world and then so quickly like can't imagine life without them. And there's sort of this general consensus that voice interaction is poised to kind of impact UX design, just like mobile touchscreens turned web design completely on its head. And it's sort of on its way to becoming just like an actually inherently expected offering or highly demanded option, even a full replacement to kind of traditional visual interfaces. And if you look at so many of the things that we're trying to do these days, like you look at portal gaming or self-driving cars, voice is like such an enormous part of that. And as it gets broader, inevitably like advertising is going to have to meet somewhere in the middle. And it's just, yeah, it's such a rich topic. I'd love to do a whole episode in this, but in this amount of time, I guess all I can say is who knows.
Thank you so much, Lara. Great insight there. And we'll wrap up from here. As always, the final link of the week comes from our guest. Ari, you are posting a Twitter link today, but I'm just curious, before we dive into that, tell us a bit more about your internet hygiene and where you kind of get your links from. Are you active on Twitter? Does it mostly come from there? Where else does it kind of, do things pop up?
I like to say that I'm the combined effort of everyone I've ever known, and my internet findings are very much a combination of links that people send me, and then I go down the black hole or the vortex and find
classic
more.
I know that feeling.
Yeah, I even find myself going through some clickbait stuff, which is just terrible now. But I'm really interested, obviously, in the beauty industry, even though I feel like we're trying to do like very different to what else is going on and what other brands are doing. But it's important for me to understand and to look at other brands, whether it's like fashion or tech, that can influence us. I have a lot of friends that send me links regarding management and like personal development, because that's something else that I'm really interested in. And even my dad sends me an inspirational link every day on Instagram. It's crazy. It's really nice. But it's like there's so much content out there which can be quite overwhelming. And I have a huge sort of like open tab or like reading list, which I wonder if I'll ever get to.
Yeah, you're our people.
So I'll quote on this one that you brought to us by Michael Siebel, or Sebel, one of the partners at Y Combinator, the kind of startup accelerator in San Francisco. And it's a bit of a kind of thread, but I'll just read the first post here, which he goes on to say, "When I was young, I thought management was about distribution / delegation of responsibilities. I now realize it is truly about the maintenance of morale and motivation. Morale and motivation are moving targets that require consistent and proactive efforts to maintain." There's a few other tweets below. I might just kind of go because they're interesting to read out. He says, "Motivation is often the difference between a C-work product and an A-work product. Founders and managers should be hypersensitive to motivation. Often your actions / example in the workplace affect motivation far more than you might realize." So, Ari, why did this resonate with you? Is this kind of something that you're faced with at the moment?
I think it's this like ever moving beast for me, to be honest. And I was so interested in hearing both your guys' take. And it's something that I'm always looking to discuss with people, because I don't think you ever really nail being a boss or a manager or a leader. It's something that I'm constantly learning about. And I'm really interested in this role of a founder or a manager in any size business, and in particular, how that relates to success of said business. I studied journalism and I still call myself a copywriter, but I find myself gravitating towards this managerial role. And I'm actually really stoked about that. Like, I love it. I never would have thought that I would fall into that, or let alone want to define myself as that. But managing staff has been the hardest thing I've ever done, but honestly the most rewarding. And it's a conversation I love having with people, whether they're managers themselves or just staff, and their experience with their founders or managers.
And of the two kind of, I guess, the two poles that he talks about in this tweet, like, do you find yourself that you gravitate towards one or the other, or has that changed a bit in the different kind of businesses that you've started or worked in?
I connected with the tweet instantly because it feels like my experience in at first thinking that it's all about delegation and responsibilities and task lists, and really realizing that these are human beings that I'm dealing with. And my motivation is one thing that I have to think about constantly, and learning to be vulnerable with my staff and help them motivate me. But how I do instill motivation in them every day. And Fluff has been this incredible journey, but it's a slow journey for us. Slower is faster. But that means that there's going to be a lot of pain points and a lot of discussions we have, and our morale and our motivation is constantly tested.
I thought it was interesting because when you look, sort of delegation, task list versus morale, motivation, if you hire the right people and you're taking care of they are motivated and they're engaged and the morale is high, whatever, then hopefully they will then take care of the delegation and the task list stuff. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's, I think one like can precede the other. Jeremy, you're like laughing. Is that not the case?
No. Absolutely. I mean, this was definitely a real big one. I mean, we've talked about this so many times with other, small business owners, and it opens up a lot of questions. And I think, for me as a business owner, I didn't expect it. It kind of came from, not left field in a way, but I kind of felt the reason people get into business is to distribute and delegate, is because they want to not have to do the things themselves, And then you realize, to get other people to do those things, it is, that morale motivation comes from you. Like, everything is really a reflection of you in some ways, like as the business owner. Like, it is kind of this reflection all the time. Like, if you're not demonstrating that activity, and like if you are not engaged with it in a way that you're trying to delegate it, then I think that can become a really vicious cycle. And that's kind of how I think bad culture kind of starts, kind of in that way.
So for me, I'm really interested, I think, Jeremy, in understanding how your management style has changed over the years and if that has been the result of just natural progression being in business over time, or if you have actively pursued or put time and energy into learning either managerial skills or leadership skills, or if it comes from more of a place of personal development or spiritual growth, which is a big thing for me. And I often look at the differences between my business partner, Charles, and I, and our management kind of approaches or our processes. And it's, I think it has to be a balance, but we're like very split down the middle. So
that's also interesting. I mean, I think when you have a business partner or someone kind of there with you, like that kind of can be a great force to kind of balance those things out, where I think sometimes my energy can be a bit of an unwieldy thing. I don't know, Lara, you might have to give me some more insight there. But in terms of how my style has changed, yeah, it's really interesting. Like, I think I've deliberately not done too much kind of training for kind of overarching, you know, the uppercase M management. I have a few coaches and mentors that I've worked with over the years that kind of helped me, you know, get around kind of certain very specific issues. But I kind of also feel that, like everything else, whether it's kind of trends or generations, are always kind of reactions to everything. So I kind of grew up working, and like, you know, my dad sent me out doing volunteer work and working kind of very young, and everything that I kind of did. And I think I was led to entrepreneurship because some of the people I either admired kind of the freedom that they had, or I really hated the way they treated me or kind of did something, you know, bad or whatever, or like, or, you know, the way that I was being treated as an employee. And I think that has a huge overlap with, yeah, like my personal, you know, spiritual practice, which is a big part of my life. And I try to use my work as kind of a platform to bring that out. And I think
to be better than those who are, as in like to treat your staff better.
It's like, you know, and I think that's, you know, I've spoken about this a few times in the podcast. It's like kind of parenting as well. It's like, you know, a lot of the reason you want to kind of correct, you know, the things that your parents kind of didn't do, you know, right, or that you didn't kind of like. And so I think it's a great thing to try to have a business as a platform to kind of to do that, as well as a vehicle to kind of, I guess, achieve your own personal goals in that way as well. But yeah, like I kind of think that it's that overall idea of kind of getting out of yourself and having that kind of sense of empathy, like for our clients and for our artists. And I think working in advertising, you need a really big supply of that if you're going to do your kind of your job right. And so that's kind of what I try to kind of demonstrate in that way. And then I also, I feel like to try to kind of, in terms of keeping staff motivated, that's another part of the job, is that I think it is, you know, it always happens every week, but I find it so interesting how all the kind of like links always kind of come together, especially if you look at kind of what different kind of generations kind of want out of kind of their work and what it's kind of supposed to bring. And I think that idea of kind of bringing meaning is really important, and I'm really kind of in touch with that. And so what I try to make sure that I can do is that there is a kind of progression for everyone who kind of works for us in that way, and make sure expectations are very kind of clear on kind of what the role is. But then I think everyone, I try to get everyone to a certain point where they can like take ownership of a certain part of the business. And I think this is kind of an area that I'm kind of really, I think, struggling with the most at the moment, because we start up a lot of different side projects, this being kind of one of them.
This being one of them,
you
yes.
know, and things, because, you know, we get very excited about kind of things. We want to kind of do new things.
We're children.
We are. But yeah, like, you know, and I like kind of starting things up and getting to the point where like the plate's spinning and then I can give it to somebody else. And like, you know, like this is a great example. Like, Laura, you've kind of taken and run with this podcast and really had a huge, you know, huge part in kind of making kind of what it is, and kind of, you know, even our New York office, you know, inspired by Bianca and kind of what she wanted to do kind of personally in her travel plans. Or, you know, like Jess was a huge inspiration for Corvid and kind of, you know, working independently with artists and things like that. So I think it's great where, you know, people, we can kind of use this as a base to kind of do that from. I don't know. There's a lot in there. A lot in a small tweet. I mean, what about you, Ari? I mean, how have you been able to manage?
One of the like biggest learning things for me is how I react to certain situations, because there's so much out of our control as business owners, and we can try and put systems and processes in place and routines and regimens, but then shit happens, right? And when you're dealing with people, you're dealing with husbands, wives, daughters, boyfriends, girlfriends, stuff happens that can affect their day. And I realize that in most situations, I'm faced with a fork in the road of one way that I can react and another. And I'm getting much better at seeing both of those paths and taking the time to really like consciously choose which one I go down, as opposed to just reacting and then the chain of reacts that occur afterwards. It's really hard, especially when we are under pressure at Fluff and I feel, I guess, a dip in my own motivation and morale. And one of the kind of conversations that stems off the back of that thread was made, in which someone says, one of the biggest challenges I have as a leader is maintaining that steady face of optimism for team's morale despite volatility in my own. And I feel that often. There are days where I don't really want to come to work or I just can't deal with it, but I have to show up and smile, or I'm learning to be more vulnerable with my staff and let them know when I am stressed and when I am worried and when I am concerned, without making them either feel guilty or bad, or spreading that stress or concern.
I think a lot of bosses or managers don't do that. Like, they don't consciously do that. And that's like definitely something that I, you know, observe, like Jeremy consciously, you know, one thing I always talk about, like, I just like don't think I've ever seen Jeremy like angry or upset with a staff member. I've seen him angry. I mean, like angry being on hold with Westpac for ages or like angry with the council when we can't get permits for stuff. But like, no, like never with an employee. And I think like so many people think that you have to lead with anger or fear to sort of motivate people. But the alternative, like leading by example, by being genuinely empathetically invested in your employees so that they feel instinctively like the same way about you and your company, is a far better motivator. And that sort of like patience and education go far further in kind of developing successful, happy, productive employees. But a lot of people do not see it that way or behave that way. And I even like, it's one of those things that like, oh, I have to take that with me. But also I am a very like volatile person, right? And like sometimes that makes me really good at the things that I do. But I always think that that would actually kind of make me a really bad manager. Like I shouldn't be saying this like publicly, but I think one of the biggest skills, as you were saying, like it was such a big thing for you to learn, but one of the biggest skills for anyone to learn, particularly anyone with my kind of personality type, would be that, yeah, that consciously deciding to take a patient sort of understanding path.
Yeah. For me, a lot of this, everything comes back to communication.
And yes.
When I am conversing with anyone, whether that's a client or a supplier or manufacturer, my staff or my business partner, it's about really like truly listening, like actively hearing what that person is saying, not just being present in the words hitting your eardrums, and trying to understand their intent or what it is that they're really saying, and looking past maybe their delivery, which we often react to, and be like, what are they getting at? And that's something that I struggle with at times. Like I react to people's reactions and it's
something, which is natural.
Yeah. But it's something that I'm aware of and really trying to put a lot of time and energy into. Lara, I wanted to ask you if there were any personal or professional skills that you've learned from Jeremy that you think makes him a great leader.
Here I am. Well, shower me with your praise.
As much as I don't want to sort of contribute to Jeremy's head getting any fucking bigger. No, I mean, Jeremy's obviously a great leader. And I do generally think all the time about how bloody well he does what is a very difficult job. I think not only actually what he's done with the company, but I guess the way he manages us as a team, which is, I mean, really like a key primary part of his role, you know? And I think, you know, as we touched on before, like the work that we do can be very stressful, very demanding. And, you know, honestly, I think it comes down to the very carefully crafted of culture and support that we have here that enables us to find that difficult work rewarding rather than like destroying. You know, I think it would be like kind of truly impossible to sort of list all the things that I've witnessed or learned from Jeremy, but I'll mention like some key things. Obviously, the first thing was that like that kind of patience and education over like just getting angry or upset. You know, like I've literally never seen Jeremy get angry or upset with a staff member, which is, I've been here for 5 years. I've been angry and upset with staff members. So, you know, but I think as well, one other thing which you kind of touched on is kind of the role that embracing and exploring tech can play in like making everyone's lives much easier and what that can do for productivity and happiness overall. I think whether it's little things like the way that calendars are set up or documenting processes or using things like Slack or Basecamp or so on, and always like making sure that you're like, are we doing this in the best way? Am I saving people time? You know, like I know that every company does this to some extent, but when you really put time and effort as a boss and then as a team to sort of utilize these things in a way that's specific to your company workflow, there's kind of this knock-on effect of fluidity and efficiency that's like really, really valuable. And then like off the back of that, I guess the second thing I'd mention is kind of flexibility and understanding what is really important. And I think that, again, comes back to what you were saying about understanding what people are actually saying and what they need. And I guess like in whatever work you're doing, it's so important to recognize what things are truly crucial, what isn't, and then having flexibility to work around certain things can sort of make for a much happier team. And that might mean some people working from home or adjusting someone's workload or making a sort of concerted effort to help people develop the skills that they want for the next job, or, you know, and that can sort of manifest in all sorts of ways. But I think a general openness to the idea that each staff member that you manage is going to need different things from you in different ways. And then being able to adapt and provide for that is really key. And it also means that you leave space for the things that are really important, you know, if you're happy to be flexible about other stuff that isn't. And then the last thing I would just note is like the effort put into hiring the right people in the first place.
Yeah.
I've been in lots of workplaces where they haven't done that very well. And I think that's something we put a huge amount of emphasis on here. And we've talked about it on the podcast before, but you know, this whole like stitch in time saves nine or buy cheap, buy twice. So not a great thing to say about humans, but you know what I mean? Putting in the real work to hire people that are the right fit for the company in terms of the role, their goals, the culture, et cetera, you know, and ensuring that not only are they able to give you what you need, but that you can give them what they need out of their professional lives is so unbelievably crucial. Because like, if you set things up, like setting things up correctly from the beginning is so core to what we do as producers, right? And so applying that, translating that, you know, to hiring as well is definitely something that I'll take with me.
Thank you so much, Laura.
Yeah, don't worry. I'll insult you later just to bring you back down to earth.
Ari, thank you so much for bringing this link to us. And yeah, I look forward to reading kind of more of your insights as a manager and business owner and everything that you're doing with Fluff. So really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. It's been great.
Before we say goodbye, though, we will do our final segment, the brilliantly named Thumbs Up, Thumbs Down, Shaka, the time every week we dedicate to get the good, the bad, so-so off our chest. Laura, what do you got for us this week?
I had a few shit things. And then while we were talking, I accidentally came across something. It's a website called designtitles.com. And it's basically a generator of like fake creative industry titles. You know how people are like chief explorer, storytelling and whatever.
Yeah.
It's pretty good. The one I first came up on was Future Explorer of Prototypes, which I quite liked. Spiritual Designer, Magician of Design, Participant of Incongruent Devices. It's very good. And you just keep clicking the refresh thing, Appearance Amazing. Diplomat. So anyway, we'll put that link in the show notes because it's quite fun to waste some time with.
Yeah, I've heard Director of First Impressions.
Oh, for fuck's sake.
Ari, what about you? Anything you'd like to particularly endorse or disendorse this week or just kind of chat about?
Oh, there's so much that I love and hate about the world. It changes every single day. And
I feel ya.
Often grounded in social media and the things that pop up on my Explore feed, particularly because of what the Explore feed serves me based on what I click on. And a lot of it is spent looking at this younger audience and what they're doing. I have a sort of thumbs up and thumbs down response then, I guess.
Please.
In that I really love this young artist, Billie Eilish.
Oh, yes.
Everyone's talking about
her. We just did some work with her.
Yes.
Oh, you guys can.
She's 17 or something.
Yeah.
It's
so she is an incredible artist. Like, her music is amazing. I can't stand her on social. Sorry, Billie. Just this like vibe that she's going for is so crazy. And my friend sent me an interview from her where she spoke about all the hardships she'd been in, the torturous relationships she's had at 15.
Jesus.
And I was like, mate, I don't think I'd even looked at a boy, but okay.
She's got some things coming.
But she's an amazing artist. I'll give her that.
Good stuff.
Jeremy, what about you?
I'm going to give a big thumbs up to solar power, which has been like, I don't know, we just had solar installed at our
Jeremy's
office.
Jeremy's just discovered it.
I have, well, you know, it's one of those things, it's hard to kind of figure out because it is very kind of complicated, but it's one of those things that's just kind of like been on my list for kind of so long. It's like every time, every time I read something terrible about, you know, everything, I was like, I need to start doing something better, you know? And it's like, I know this is kind of just a very, very kind of small thing, but it feels good to have something on your list so long and actually kind of get to it, basically. But also there's a really interesting kind of gamification part of it as well now, because now I have this app that tell me how much solar I'm generating, and I'm just kind of
worst time of year to get it installed.
Absolutely the worst, but you know what? That just means there's something amazing to look forward to that I'm very kind of excited about. So yeah, I would just kind of do a big endorsement for solar. And I think especially if you're in Australia, there's so many different kind of schemes, like in the positive way, that the government can kind of, you know, offset some of the cost. And I think in terms of what's happening with batteries as well, like they're kind of adding it down the track, like that's going to become like more affordable and make that backup system a whole kind of new thing. But yeah, solar, sunshine, even though we're not getting any of it anymore, that's kind of what I'm going for. Ari, if people want to find out more about you, Fluff, and everything that you do, where can they do that on the internet?
Their best bet is itsallfluff.com.
Excellent.
And that can take you through to our socials, itsall.fluff. But on the website, yeah, you can sign up to my email updates, which I should really do one again soon.
Well, hopefully we do a bit of a recap from your trek at all.
Yeah, definitely.
I'd love to read. Thank you so much again for coming on the show. It's great to have you.
Thanks, guys.
We love you.
I'm Jeremy Wartzman, she's Laura Chan Baker, and this has been Jackie Winter Gives You the Business. Our theme music is by, totally unrelated to our company, Melbourne-based musician Jackie Winter. You can check out his stuff on soundcloud.com/Jackie Winter. And if you want more JYGYTB, archives of all of our shows can be found at jackiewinter.givesyouthe.biz. And to receive all the links we talk about in one nice little package, you can sign up to our recently redesigned newsletter, All Things Jackie Winter, All Things Podcast, at jwg.is/newslettering. Again, jwg.is/newslettering. You can also find us mostly on Instagram at Jackie Winter. That's Jackie with a Y and Winter like the season. And hit us up with any recommendations, etc. at podcast@jackiewinter.com. Remember, this is an enhanced podcast. If you listen to this with End of Compatible Player, you'll get to see all the articles that we're talking about and other visual content as we go on. And if you work for an ad agency or design studio and are interested in our live extended version of the show called Open Tabs, be sure to check out opentabs.rodeo for more info. That is all for this week. Thank you so much for listening. We'll catch you next week. Bye. Bye. Exactly.
How the fuck you do it? This is the first time I've missed breakfast in so long, and I want to punch someone.
Oh,
I can't function without food.
The almonds will get you through.
Oh, they're so good.